I'm going to temporarily open a public hearing on H.J.R. 4 for the purposes of allowing my good friend, Senator Nelson, to testify. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. And members of the committee, my name is David Nelson, state senator representing four counties out in eastern Oregon, Umatilla, Union, Wallowa, and Morrow counties. And I'm here to come and testify in support of House Joint Resolution 4. I have submitted some written testimony from Catherine Britton, who is the president of the Oregon Telehealth Alliance and chair of the OTCC Telehealth Committee. The history of this, you know, this thing just isn't appearing out of the blue. In 1999, with the help of Kathy Britton and several other folks, we passed out Senate Bill 622, which is the telecommunications broadband high-speed fiber thing. Part of that was the health care, the access that would be available then in rural Oregon. And Kathy Britton has stayed involved in that since that time, and so this is just kind of a continuation of that. As I understand this bill, it's an encouragement that healthcare payers to reimburse for services. It's not a mandate. It's just a tool to help negotiations, and so we're setting out a policy of some sort that, you know, we want to be able to continue to use the telecommunications for healthcare access and to kind of bring the parties together. So it's more of a statement of principle or policy rather than asking for any money. I can tell just from on a personal basis, having watched medical opinions being given in Pelton, Oregon, from doctors at St. Charles in Bend. Just a unique, remarkable thing to do, and I think maybe today you're going to be having some sort of telecommunications thing that can indicate that. I mean, there's just huge possibilities. We all know we're under monetary constraints and difficulties, and, you know, we have to look at doing things differently, getting access to people out in rural Oregon, and so I'm very supportive of this concept, and I know there's some amendments probably being proposed to this thing, and hope that you folks will consider it, and I just want you to know that I'm in support of it, and I thank you for your time, and would answer any questions if you're...
Any questions for the senator? Yeah. And there are amendments coming, and we're going to hopefully get them before we actually get to that part of the agenda.
Well, so, thank you for your consideration, Chair.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on H.J.R. 4 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2305. Sandy?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2305 is one piece of a package of bills in addressing the HIPAA, which is the Health Insurance Portability Accountability Act. In 2001, the legislature enacted Senate Bill 104, which established an advisory committee. This is one of those efforts of that advisory committee. The other four pieces of legislation are in judiciary. This one has been requested to be put with that package too, but we're going to receive some information.
Okay, and just for the committee's information, not this next week, but the week after, in Representative Westland's Audit Committee, we're going to have as full a presentation on HIPAA as we can do in a two-hour block. We could probably do a six-month presentation on HIPAA. It's gotten so complicated, but we're going to do that there. I think it would be... I'm not sure there's a whole lot we can do about it, but understanding it is certainly going to be helpful as we deliberate on all things around the health plan and other issues. So, Paul.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Frisch. My day job is at the Oregon Medical Association as their Director of Medical Legal Affairs, but I appear before you today as Vice Chair of the Senate Bill 104 or Advisory Committee on Privacy of Medical Information and Records. And I am bringing an apology from our chair, Neil Bryant. Many of you know Mr. Bryant has a court appearance today and couldn't be with us. My job is just to tell you that the Senate Bill 104 committee has been hard at work. We have these five bills. HIPAA is, as you have said, Mr. Chair, a very complicated piece of legislation. But I think the good news is that the proposals that are on the table from the committee suggest that we are not going to have a wholesale upside-down turning of privacy laws in Oregon. I think Oregon had established some good privacy policy, and these bills are largely to bring Oregon into line with the language of HIPAA and some of the regulations. And our focus and goal is to try to bring to you as clear a picture of what needs to be done as possible. And I think that's been done in these pieces of legislation. What is before you in 2305 focuses primarily on the hospital physician and other healthcare clinicians' responsibilities. There is some change in the language of our statutory authorization and a few other very important features. But by and large, as I look at it, from the standpoint of the citizens of the state of Oregon, they're going to have a much clearer picture of what their rights and what the duties of healthcare providers are in terms of healthcare privacy as a result of these changes. And I look forward to working with everyone on this. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions? Yes.
If I could, in the list of people, it starts out psychologists, occupational therapists, so professional counselor, would that include like peer counselors? And the reason I ask that, there is some legislation, there's some problems with peer counseling in the public safety sector a few years ago where they could be required to give up information that was being I just want to be self-protected.
Yes. If in the draft subsection Y of Section 4, where it defines healthcare provider, there is a catch-all at the bottom that speaks about any other person or entity that furnishes bills or is paid for healthcare in the normal course of business. So, thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, I think that's the answer.
Okay. And in looking at this, and it is my intention to send it to Judiciary so it can be dealt with in the context of the other bills. And some other conversations is kind of what led me to wanting a 101 for our committee and the audit committee on this issue. So I think we can go more in depth into the intricacy point, because I have a feeling you'll be there.
I have a feeling I will, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate that. I think it will be a good opportunity for all of us to get up to speed.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Nobody else signed up, so we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2305 and open a work session on House Bill 2305, and I would entertain a motion to refer this to the Judiciary Committee.
So moved.
Okay. Representative Barker moves House Bill 2305 to the Committee on Judiciary with or without recommendation. Just move it?
Just move it.
Okay. Without recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Dalton?
Excused.
Representative Moses Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wesley?
Excused.
Chair, please.
Cruz votes aye. House Bill 2305, having received the required majority, is declared passed and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. And I will close the work session on 2305 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2325. Sandy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2325 is once again at the request of the Health Licensing Office. This is... looks like to be a big bill, but
it's
just
simple
covers
little bill.
Well, it is relatively simple. It just covers a lot of statutes. What this is doing, 9 boards that have been put under the umbrella of the licensing office, they are changed, all had individual statutes. This is combining those 9 into one centrally located area under the health licensing statutes.
Okay. Susan?
Good morning, Chair Cruz, members of the committee. I'm Susan Wilson. I'm the director for the Health Licensing Agency. and Sandy did a nice job of explaining what the sick bill in front of you is going to do. We're trying to synchronize board and program statutes under the consolidated licensing umbrella. This continues to standardize support services and make the current boards conform with our language as well as our language conform with theirs. Any unique areas that relate to practice standards are preserved in each of their statutes. A little background about the Health Licensing Office. We were established by the 1999 legislature and since that time have operated very well under this system. House Bill 2325 continues to work on that consolidation process. And the primary purpose, and I'm going to summarize just basic areas within the bill rather than go through each section, but if the chair so desires, I would be happy to go through each section. It'd be lengthy, but I'm very happy to do that. In general, 2325 corrects irregularities as they relate to disciplinary and enforcement. It amends criminal penalty provisions to conform with other programs administered by our office. It conforms business practices related to corporations and facilities. It fixes provisions to comply with other state agencies that currently have shared jurisdiction for some of the programs. An example of this would be the Oregon Department of Education Career Schools. It corrects statutes to conform any language that may be improperly located in one statute, and it moves it into another statute, or it deletes that statute if it's been stated more than once. It corrects separate certificates for the Board of Cosmetology to actually match disciplines. This is an old law change in 1977, and it fixes that. It conforms that language. It changes titles for two of our professionals. It doesn't change practice standards, but it changes their titles. Those two organizations are registered sanitarians. They have a national title that conforms them to the national standard of environmental health specialists. In the bill, it appears as licensed, and I'll get to that later. We are changing that through an amendment. The other group is hearing aid dealers. This particular group is also trying to conform their title to a national standard and changing dealer to specialist. I want to assure the committee that since January of 2002, we've met with over 50 organizations, boards, and associations, professional groups, and made sure we met with those stakeholders and conferred with them so there was a full understanding of the statutory changes found within this bill. They were, at that time, supportive of this legislation. So I'm here to answer questions. The committee so desires.
Okay. So do you want to speak to anything specific in the proposed amendment, seeing how we don't have them yet?
I'd be happy to go over the letter I submitted to the chair. Section 4, we're asking, again, these are amendments that are based on the bill being presented to us, and it had some omissions, and we're fixing those. It doesn't change the intent of the bill. In Section 4 in the letter, I've asked the committee to consider changing the term practitioner to person in paragraph 6. That's because it applies to a corporation and not to an industry or profession. Section 6, changing environmental health specialist licensing board, and this is that area that we said we wanted to change that to registration instead of licensing, have full support from that group. Section 19, the citations in paragraph 2 are changed. Those are just law citation numbers that didn't get changed. Section 23, this language needed to be deleted, didn't get deleted because it already appears in Section 28. Section 33, again, appears in Section 34, needs to be deleted. Section 70, being replaced again, it's in 72. And Section 87, the citations in the paragraph need to be changed. Section 89 through 117, this is the big section of the bill because environmental health specialist appears in so many places. We have to change it in many places in other laws, and so that's being changed to registered environmental health specialists. And then Section 118, add citations to make sure that the links go back to the specific boards, and it does a numbering a numeric process for direct injury midwives, respiratory care therapists, the Advisory Council on Electrology, tattooists, body piercing, the entire group.
Okay, so in essence, the amendments are just fixing little things that often happen in a bill this size. Any questions?
On the changes from hearing aid dealers to hearing aid specialists, I had somebody said that's conforming to the rules. I also had somebody else come in and tell and say they thought that was the term specialist was indicative of of more training than they might have, and they were concerned about that and thought maybe it the hearing aid providers or something other than specialist. I don't know if you could address that point or if you have any opinion or.
Chair Cruz, Representative Baker. I believe that the agency felt that it was only a terminology change when we added it to the law. There's no practice standard changes that were attached to it. It was presented by a council member and by the National Association as being a term that is universally used. No. I don't have an opinion that specialist means more than specialist, but that would be the committee's decision. And I believe there are people in the audience today that might want to speak to that and could answer that question specifically.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm generally in agreement with the housekeeping measures of this bill. I had a question on a little different area, and that is... having seen what I would consider to be some possible abuses, does the Board of Denture Technology or your health licensing agency have authority over denturists who are operating outside the scope of their practice?
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, that is one of the citations we actually raised from a class C to a B misdemeanor, and specifically over the practice of practicing outside of their. If a denturist was practicing dentistry, we would refer that citation or that alleged penalty to the Board of Dentistry because it would be within their jurisdiction. The same would be true if an accusation came forward that a denture technologist or anyone else was practicing nursing. That's something that our AGs work together. We would work together in collaboration to make sure that the consumer was taken care of. But we would send that
refer it to
the consumer board. Complaint to the board that had jurisdiction to take action against someone that was practicing outside their scope of practice or in another scope of practice.
Any other questions? Thank you. Scott Austin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and distinguished committee members. I'm Scott Austin, a board-certified hearing aid specialist and immediate past president of the International Hearing Society and a current member of the Advisory Council on Hearing Aids overseen by the Health Licensing Office. Today I'm representing the Oregon Hearing Society, the Trade Association for Hearing Aid Specialists, to discuss House Bill 2325, specifically the topic of changing the name from hearing aid dealers to hearing aid specialists. Without belaboring your committee with the never-ending turf battle between some, not all, audiology groups and hearing aid specialists, we feel that the opposition to this name change has no valid merit in its explanation that the term hearing aid specialist may mislead consumers into thinking that they are working with a more highly trained person than may actually be the case. In a recent newsletter of the Oregon Speech, Language, and Hearing Association, the president's message was misleading to its members, stating that the association will work to steer support of alternative language for hearing aid dealers who wish to be defined as hearing specialist. The correct term is hearing aid specialist, as we only specialize in the selection, fitting, and dispensing of hearing aids. The proposed change of title is included in this legislative bill simply to update the current Oregon law related to hearing aid sales and distribution. Currently, 32 states, including D.C., define our profession as either specialist or dispenser. 18 states refer to fitters, providers, dealers. The current U.S. Federal Standards of Occupation Classification recognizes hearing aid specialist, a change that took over 10 years to implement and was noted in the 2000 edition of the SOC manual issued by the office. I've attached a copy of page 96, and at the bottom you will see the term hearing aid specialist. In addition, America's Hearing Healthcare Team, founded by the American Academy of Otolaryngology, the physicians who specialize in diseases of the ear, and the International Hearing Society, recognizes hearing aid specialists as those who assess hearing and select, fit, and dispense hearing aids and related devices. There's also an attachment for, regarding that. Since 1959, when Oregon passed the first licensing law in the country for hearing aid specialists, we have been a role model for many other states, and now all 50 states have regulations or licensing requirements for our profession. We've wished to change this title for many years, but recognize the legislature's desire not to open up laws to make simple name changes. We decided to include this change while the law was being reviewed and other changes were necessary. Webster's Online Dictionary defines specialist as one who specializes in a particular occupation, practice, or branch of learning. This is not a ploy to mislead the public. Hindering this change is simply an attempt to keep the competition down. The term dealer is often associated with that of used car dealer, drug dealer, etc., and sheds a negative image on a career which has grown in its professionalism, expertise, and education requirements. We specialize in hearing aids, and it's as simple as that. And we encourage you and your committee to see this as an improvement and hope that you will see fit to call us what we truly are. Thank you again for allowing this testimony, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
I'd just like to state for the record that the committee recognizes there's quite a difference between used car dealers and drug dealers.
I would hope so.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
You mentioned education.
Yes.
Tell us, please, what the education would be for
okay,
every
currently,
year.
In the last 2 years, the committee has raised the training requirements and the number of hours pre-licensing training requirements to sit for the licensing examination. Current industry standards, the Oregon Hearing Society implemented continuing education requirements for hearing aid specialists.
That is what?
9 hours of continuing education, and there is some talk that we want to raise that. We're kind of a self-governing group, and we like to promote the profession of hearing aid specialists. And so,
is that 9 hours total or 9 hours per year?
9 hours per year.
Per year.
9 hours per year. Mm-hmm. And it's worked. And it's very consistent throughout the country. Another thing is there are several, there are two currently in the country, community college two-year affiliate or associate degree programs for hearing aid specialists.
But that's not required.
And not required in Oregon. It is required in Washington.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jane Myers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jane Myers representing the Oregon Dental Association, and we signed up as neutral on the bill and did want to take a minute and say we recognize the Health Licensing Office. Its director has worked really hard to let us know what was going on with the bill, and making the statutes more consistent is a good agenda for the Health Licensing Office, and we support that idea. What we wanted to do is raise an issue here because of the process of legislation. Ballot measure 24 passed in November, and there may be at some point, we're trying not to have to do this with legislation, maybe we can do it with rulemaking, to make some concerns known to the Legislative Committee and to the Health Licensing Office about the need for patients to have a competent diagnosis and an evaluation explanation of their treatment options when they're going to receive a partial removable denture. And in here I wrote, this is a description by one of the dentists. I want you to know I didn't make this up. This is the basic question that needs to be addressed is, as he states, the periodontal, pulpal, and restorative status of each tooth to be used as a partial denture abutment must be known. And this data can be obtained without, cannot be obtained without a dental and radiographic examination. it would be malpractice for a dentist to use a tooth for a partial denture abutment that had severe periodontal bone loss or paraparesiform pathology requiring a root canal. And the information can only be obtained with the help of a good quality paraparesiform radiographs. And that's what brings up the question. You have two professions trying to satisfy patient safety concerns here. How that information will come forward is the crux of the matter, and we think the Health Licensing Office and the denture technology licensees need to address the issue. And we understand this bill was not intended to answer the questions that arise from passage of Ballot Measure 24, and perhaps some of the solutions might be available in rulemaking. Otherwise, legislation may be needed to bring the agency's ability to protect the public safety interest in line with the expanded scope granted to the denturist in the initiative. And at this point, we're not sure of the answer to the question. And it is, I think, Representative Anderson's question about agency authority over people working outside of their scope is a good one. In a way, it's a shift of the burden to discipline denturists who may get outside of their scope in dealing with diagnosis for partial dentures to another agency. And we're concerned about those questions because the licensees of the Board of Dentistry support that board with their fees. And, you know, it does have an effect, much like taxpayers' effects, when agencies have more work to do. So I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
However, 24 did pass, and that's our reality. Jane, do you folks have any legislation in the pipeline to address your concerns, or are you assuming you're going to do it all in rule?
We do not at the moment have any legislation in the pipeline, Chair Cruz.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have there been cases now that dentists have had... people who were improperly fitted by denture?
Representative Cruz and members of the committee, in answer to your question, before the ballot measure passed, there were some cases. There was some discipline from the Attorney General's office against, I think it was four denturists who were working outside of their scope at that time. Since then, I don't know. I don't have access to complaints that might have been filed with the board. I have had dentist members call and complain after passage of the measure saying, when is the measure effective, because we're already seeing advertisements stating that someone with a denturist license could provide a partial removable denture. I don't know what happened to those complaints.
Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and responding to Representative Mona Sanderson, having practiced this area for 35 years, it's only in the maybe the last 20 years that dentistry itself has been fully cognizant of the problems of periodontal disease. And it's really not a problem when all the teeth are missing to put a denture on. But when you're putting a denture on teeth that are badly broken down or very involved in terms of the structure holding that tooth, the bone, the ligaments around the tooth, you can get into some major problems for the patient. And I can't point to you specific instances. The four here, I'm sure, are a problem. But with the profession itself, having had four or more years specializing in that area, coming up to speed quickly in the last 20 years, I'd have to think that those who are not highly trained in dealing with teeth, as opposed to just dealing with gum tissue, I'd have to think there are quite a few abuses. And so it'd be interesting to get those figures as best we can.
But I think I'd also have to say that this bill doesn't necessarily impact that, and if we hadn't made this creative shift of these authorities in 99, the problem would still be the same as it is. So, any other questions? Thank you, Jane. And committee, we have written testimony for the record from John McCauley. and there's no other testimony, we will bring this back when we have the amendments. And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2325. And we will, are we ready to do four? Okay. I'm going to reopen the public hearing on HJR 4. We already kind of had a estimation from the good senator, so.
We're
going to
turn the video?
Yeah, we're going to watch movies. There they are. This, Ben, be good. Come on up.
Chairman Cruz, thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Chairman Cruz, members of the committee. I'm a bit new to this, so bear with me.
You're doing fine so far.
Oh, that's great. My name is Kim Hoffman. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I am an ex officio member of the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council, a member of that council's healthcare committee, and also a member of the Oregon Telehealth Alliance. In my real job, I'm the outreach coordinator for Oregon Health and Science University, but I'm not representing them in this manner. You will find some written testimony from President Kohler and Karen Whitaker from OHSU in support of this resolution, however. We are here to talk to you about House Resolution 4. This is a resolution that was developed by the Healthcare Committee from ORTCC and the Oregon Telehealth Alliance to address reimbursement issues for telemedicine. Now, I'm sure you're all aware that the ORTCC was put together by the 71st Legislative Assembly to look at ways to expand connectivity throughout Oregon. A part of its mission was also to look at how to use those that telecommunications connectivity, and one of its focuses has been on telemedicine. I think it's recognized that telemedicine can be a tool to address some of our economic issues and also the healthcare shortages in our rural communities today. For your information, the ORTCC Healthcare Committee is comprised of representatives now from health systems, from payers, independent telecommunications consultants representing communities throughout Oregon, as well as other organizations who are interested in the advancement of telemedicine in Oregon. And one of the outcomes of the work of that group was the organization of a new 501c3 group called the Oregon Telehealth Alliance. And the Oregon Telehealth Alliance is also comprised of a cross-section of health systems, payers, and others interested in advancing telemedicine in Oregon. We recognize that one of the biggest obstacles in being able to do that is reimbursement for services. Telemedicine in Oregon over the last 3 to 4 years has actually been rapidly expanding through activities of groups like Asante, Peace Health, OHSU, Cascade Health Systems. But there are still challenges. One of the biggest challenges in the past has been the connectivity, but through such things as Senate Bill 622 and the work of the ORTCC, those are being addressed. The single biggest issue right now is reimbursement for services. Until providers in health systems, such as the ones I mentioned, can be reimbursed, it's difficult for them to give their time to providing these services to rural communities. In order to address this, the Healthcare Committee and the OTA developed House Joint Resolution 4. And just very briefly, there are six components of this bill that we're taking. And you actually are seeing some of challenges with conferencing right now, as a matter of fact. Basically, this resolution, we're asking for support in some policies that we'd like to develop for reimbursement for telemedicine in Oregon. And these include, we would like to have providers who are reimbursed for in-house services now. When they see a patient in their offices and are reimbursed for a service, we would like them to be reimbursed for that same service if it's delivered telemedically, where the patient is remote from their clinical office. We believe that any service that can be reimbursable for an in-person visit with a physician should be reimbursable if it's delivered. With the exception of the appropriate use of store and forward technology, reading of x-ray exams remotely, echocardiograms, and that sort of thing, we are specifically asking for reimbursement for clinician-to-patient activities. We're not asking for reimbursement for clinician-to-clinician activities. Those services are not currently reimbursed under most health plans, and we're not asking to add that. We're addressing specifically what is currently reimbursed in an in-person visit. We want reimbursed telemedically. We believe that in order to receive telemedicine services, a patient should sign a consent form so they fully understand what they are doing, and also to cover some of the HIPAA requirements that, of course, will be there. We believe that a patient should have a right to choose whether they are seen in person with a clinician or telemedically if that option exists. So if they choose to travel the 300 miles to see the physician, they should be able to do that. But if they choose to receive that service telemedically, that should be an option for them as well. And finally, we would like to leave the door open to negotiate with payers for reimbursement for transmission costs. In some instances, health plans will cover travel costs for patients. We would like to have the option of trying to recoup some of the transmission costs, some of the line costs, when appropriate. We have had a lot of discussions in our Oregon Telehealth Alliance group about whether we should try to legislate this reimbursement, and have there's been a lot of collaboration between the payers and the providers and other members, and we really would like to do this through negotiation rather than legislation at this point. We're confident that we can make that work. If it turns out that we can't, then we might have to come back legislatively, but we are confident that we can do this through negotiation at this point. I have several other people with me from the Oregon Telehealth Alliance who would like to testify in front of you today. Ed Parker from Parker Telecommunications in Lincoln City will be speaking next. Following him, Eric Alexander, who is the Chief Operating Officer of Cascade Health Systems in Bend, will be speaking. St. Charles Medical Center has a pretty advanced telehealth program. And Josie Henderson from the Association of Telehealth Service Providers will speak last and give a national perspective. And after that, we'd be happy to entertain any questions you have. Okay. With that, I'll turn it over to Ed. Ed?
Good morning, Ed.
My name is Ed Parker. Thank you. Chairman Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Ed Parker. I'm a telecommunications consultant who lives and works in Glen Eden Beach on the Central Oregon coast. I'm a member of the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council and its telehealth committee. I'm also a member of the Samaritan Health Services Telehealth Advisory Committee, and I'm speaking to you today from Samaritan North Lincoln Hospital in Lincoln City. The Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council found that while there is still a need for improved telecommunications infrastructure in much of rural Oregon, there is an even more pressing need to remove barriers to the effective use of the telecommunications infrastructure we already have. Telemedicine applications that improve the availability of quality of health care are potential major users of broadband telecommunications infrastructure in rural Oregon. The federal government has designated our part of rural Oregon, Lincoln County, as a health professional shortage area. We particularly lack specialist physicians in a number of medical specialties, and as a result, many patients from our communities must travel to Portland, Salem, or Corvallis for specialist consultations and treatment. The availability and quality of medical service for rural residents in our county and throughout Oregon will be improved when patients in rural communities can consult with physicians in urban Oregon without the expense and inconvenience of travel. The primary barrier to such consultations is not one of technology or infrastructure. It is the obvious fact that such consultations will not take place regularly if the consulting physicians cannot get paid for their services. Currently, the Oregon Health Plan and most third-party health insurers in Oregon do not reimburse physicians for consultations that are other than face-to-face, in-person consultations. Medicare does reimburse for consultations, you know, by telemedicine if the patient is in a non-metropolitan county. Medicaid programs in 20 other states reimburse for telemedicine consultation, even though the Oregon Health Plan does not. Because the Oregon Health Plan reimburses patients for travel expenses as well as paying the fees of the consulting physician, the Oregon Health Plan should be able to save money by permitting rural patients to consult with physicians by telemedicine without as much long-distance travel. Third-party insurers such as Blue Cross Blue Shield reimburse for telemedicine consults in several other states. Although the evidence is not definitive, it appears that such reimbursement has not noticeably increased the expenses of such insurers. More patients may be able to receive care than would otherwise be possible, but the quality of care received, especially for chronic disease management, may result in fewer instances of expensive medical crisis situations. The Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council and its telehealth committee believe that the changes needed in the Oregon Health Plan and in Oregon regulations of third-party health insurers can be implemented by the governor through an executive order or orders without specific legislation of the details of such orders. Therefore, we urge you to adopt the joint resolution as a matter of state policy, possibly with the inclusion of an additional whereas clause pointing out the benefit of improved access to quality health care. We assume that such a legislative statement of policy intent will be sufficient for the governor to then implement the necessary details in a manner that can be supported by both insurers and beneficiaries of health insurance. We hope that such regulations will apply to all Oregonians. Although the primary benefit will accrue to rural Oregonians, we see no need to discriminate against urban Oregonians as the federal Medicare regulations now do. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I would be pleased to answer any questions.
Yeah, thank you very much. Questions? Can you see us?
I think he can see you. He can't see us.
Oh, my God. That's got to be scary. See, it is. I knew it was. Well, what's the time delay? I mean, is the time delay pretty much standard, or is it based on distance?
It's based more on transmission rates, okay. You know, how big your pipe is, the speed that you can do your video conference. The lower speeds, you can have quite a time delay. Higher speeds, actually, this is not bad.
What do you mean higher speeds?
It's the transmission rate in which the video is sent, and you can have a transmission rate of 128 megabits per second as opposed to 784 megabits per second. And the speed at which you can transmit your video conference will help determine the delay.
Okay, is that a difference between copper and fiber, or is it something out there?
It can be copper and fiber. It can be use of the lines that you have. So if you have a lot of traffic going over a set size line, it can have an impact on how well the conference comes through. That's why it's so important when we're talking about telemedicine to have high-speed connectivity available to all parts of Oregon. And that's one of the reasons that the OTCC is so interested in doing its work and making sure that happens. We're confident that can happen, and if we can get reimbursement, we're confident this can happen. So,
well, most of the 622 loops are now complete.
Yes.
And we have this capability in all those loops, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Are we in need of POPs or what?
It kind of depends. I'm probably not the best person to answer this question, but I'll do my very best from my wealth of knowledge. Yes, Senate Bill 622 created the loops. We still have an issue of getting from that loop to an individual hospital or clinic. It's the last mile issue is still there, where we need to be able to get high-speed connectivity to the Quest line or the Quest POP. And we're still trying to deal with that. That's part of what the ORTCC is trying to deal with in coming up with public-private partnerships and all of that to get that last mile piece taken care of.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's hard for me to visualize how this works. So people, Senator Nelson had been here a little bit ago talking mm-hmm. about representation of Wallowa County. So somebody in Wallowa County goes into a clinic that has this capability. Is that how it works? And they would find a physician, a specialist, who needed to deal with the problem that the patient was presenting. Is that correct?
Yes, that would be correct. A patient could be in a clinic in Wallowa with a video unit set up in that clinic office. And that patient could be talking to a physician in Bend or Eugene or Portland, and the physician in the urban area could be seeing the patient. And actually, when we get to Eric Alexander's testimony, one of the things that St. Charles Medical Center is doing right now, they have equipment at the remote sites where they can actually have the consulting physician in Portland listening to the patient's heart, the patient's lungs, looking in the patient's ear, and seeing what they would be seeing if the patient was in the office with them, but they're seeing it remotely.
Amazing. Follow-up, please?
Oh, yeah.
How many rural areas have this?
What I would like to do is to turn this over to Eric Alexander, and Ruth Gieskind is with him. I think they could answer that question for you better than I can. I mean, with throughout Oregon, there aren't that many places that have capability. St. Charles Medical Center is probably the one health system in Oregon that is most advanced in providing that kind of capability. And I think Eric and Ruth can answer those questions for you.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay.
Just one quick question. For Ed, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Great. You might have seen Chair Cruz and I kibitzing up here at the dais. And I want to make sure I got this correct. I mean, I am aghast at this, but that Oregon Health Plan will reimburse for a physical visit, not only the mileage into the doctor's office, but the physical visit, but they will not reimburse for a teleconference sighting or visit. Is that correct, Ed?
That is my understanding.
Well, everyone in the room shaking their head up and down, too, so I think you're right. Now, the other question, how do we know you're really in Tillamook? I mean, didn't I just see you over in the Capitol gift shop a minute ago? Weren't you buying a card for your wife?
Actually, I came down the coast to Lincoln City.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ed.
Okay, Chair Cruz, yeah, with your permission, I'd like to see if we can get Eric Alexander
Absolutely.
And Ruth Gieskind up from Bend. Now, how we switch to them, I'm not sure.
I'm not either.
Nor am I.
That's on Cass's side.
I think we just need to speak to that.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, yeah.
Good morning.
Voice activated.
Hear me in.
Good morning. Welcome. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
There's a little green.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning, Chairman Cruz, members of the committee. Special hello to our representative, Ben Westland. Ben, good to see you. I'm not in the gift shop. I really am in Ben. With me this morning is Ruth Gieskind, who is the telecommunications coordinator for Cascade Health Services. And if there are technical questions that I can't answer, Ruth will certainly back me up on this. I'm appreciative for the opportunity to testify in offering support for House Joint Resolution 4. I am representing today Cascade Health Services, where I'm the Regional Chief Operating Officer. Cascade Health Services is a governing organization for St. Charles Medical Center in Bend, Central Oregon Community Hospital in Redmond, and we also have oversight through management contracts with hospitals in Prineville and in Madras. In addition, I'm representing the Central Oregon Hospital Network, where I'm the executive over that network of 8 hospitals in eastern and central Oregon. Just as an aside, before I begin, I understand there will be a demonstration later from Ben for the committee about how telemedicine works. So I think a picture will be worth a thousand words and help you understand the practical side of how this is really working.
Great.
St. Charles Medical Center. I'm sorry?
No, I'm sorry.
I'll continue.
Okay.
St. Charles Medical Center in Bend serves as essentially as a hub for specialty care for a really wide area in Oregon, some 30,000 plus square miles, six counties plus touching perhaps several other counties in eastern and central Oregon. If you've ever been a patient in the Asher Clinic in Fossil, or if you have ever been a patient in the Blue Mountain Community Hospital in John Day, I think you'll have some feeling for the relative isolation of these communities from specialty care. Both of them are 3 to 4 hours from specialty centers either in Bend or Portland or Boise or the Tri-Cities. And you can have a feel for the distance, time, and displacement issues that patients in rural areas have when they need specialty consults. As a regional hub for specialty care, St. Charles and its medical staff pioneered the use of telehealth technology for central and eastern Oregon alongside the RodeoNet activities in the early 90s. The teleradiology and tele-EKG networks that have been put in place in the early 90s, basically which allow x-rays to be transmitted over long distances or EKG strips to be transmitted over long distances, they have become really diagnostic standards of care for this region over the last decade. Clinicians, physicians, and patients in these rural areas truly depend on teleradiology and tele-EKG on a daily basis, so it's really a technology that is being utilized and proven in this region. In addition to that, we have done a lot of work and in video conferencing itself from department to department, clinician to clinician, and so on, has become a standard technology use in Eastern and Central Oregon's health system. Providing this technology to rural patients is a critical piece of the future healthcare delivery system in rural Oregon. And in particular, I'm speaking today of Central and Eastern Oregon. Without the continued development of these services, rural patients are not going to be able to have total access to services that patients in more urban areas have access to. And a fundamental building block of this system is reasonable reimbursement for providers. Particularly physicians and to some lesser degree hospitals as they see patients via telehealth technology. Without such a system, physician use of telehealth technology is going to be minimal. As previous people have testified, it's going to be minimal and anecdotal and probably suboptimal. It just isn't going to work. Simply put, physicians cannot and probably will not utilize the technology if there is no predictable means of reimbursement, and that's why this is so important. It is critically important, I guess, just to make a point again, for the patients in outside in the rural and frontier areas. We're talking about patients in Lakeview and John Day and Burns and other places. From the patients and the community's perspective, there are some key benefits, consumer advantages, if you will, to the use of telehealth technology. First of all, when telehealth consults are delivered in their home communities, physicians are actually better able to follow the care of a patient. I think the preceding discussion about how it really works is instructive here. A physician can consult directly with a specialist in another community, and the two physicians actually can consult at the same time with the patient. And that enhances quality and continuity of care in a way that is really important to the care system. Secondly, patients have access, greater access to specialists that they wouldn't otherwise see by the use of telemedicine technology. They are able to be spared long drives, in the case of Lakeview, 3.5 hours between Lakeview and Bend, long drives to specialty centers, which are costly in terms of the transportation expenses, but also the subtle and indirect expenses. of being dislocated from your job, having to give a day or two off work, travel accommodations and living accommodations, etc. Fourth, I think patients being cared for in their home communities is very important. We feel pretty strongly at Cascade Health Services, and I think other people in our central and eastern Oregon area do as well, that recovering and being treated in your home community actually enhances healing and patient recovery. And so that in that fashion, telehealth is critically important. Finally, patients who require hospitalization where appropriate are retained in their home hospital. Hospitals and communities are economic stays of communities, and anything that we can do to maintain the care close to home in their home communities through the use of technology is critical, not only to providing good health care, but to providing economic stability for communities. So in summary, I think telehealth has got great potential as a tool for expanding access to services and reducing consumer health costs. Rural Oregon, with its preponderance of small hospitals and small medical communities, offers great potential for implementing the benefits of telemedicine, but we can't do it without a rational, predictable mechanism for reimbursement for providers who use this tool. So I very much appreciate, thank you, Chairman Cruz, members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak with you today. Ruth and I are open to answer any questions you might have of us. Thank you again.
Thank you, Eric. Any questions? Lori?
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. For those of you in band, I'm Lori Monis Anderson, and I'm representative from Gresham. And I am very excited about telecommunications in all modes. And I am actually working on a nursing shortage bill that will hopefully enhance distance learning. And I am wondering, can you comment on, you know, even though you're this resolution is focused primarily on the billing aspect and being reimbursed, can you give me a little bit of information on maybe the educational component or the networking that you're doing with your nursing programs or I would just say community college probably programs? Are there sharing of classes and lectures and those types of things?
Thank you. I'd be glad to. And if Ruth, if there are some things that I missed.
Didn't hear it.
Right.
Eric,
I'd be glad to respond to that. We have a strong relationship with Central Oregon Community College in Bend, and we are working, as you suggested, with the Oregon. With the council that is dealing with the issue of nursing education in the state, we are working very collaboratively in terms of trying to find ways to expand the education opportunities to nurses throughout Central Oregon and Eastern Oregon. But it's not only nurses; it is technicians, radiology techs, and others in which the shortage is hitting us. So we see the video conferencing aspect and the distance learning aspect of this system as being equally important as the clinical aspect in dealing with this issue as it confronts us today, because it's a big issue and it's going to impact the entire state.
I would just like to add that we're also partnering with Portland Community College, and twice weekly we're offering medical terminology in Spanish interpreter classes via video conference, two students here at St. Charles, and then also to three of our rural locations. So with that in mind, the telecommunications system that we already have in place is serving educationally as well.
Representative.
AHEC is sponsoring that program.
Thank you so much. I'm just thrilled, and hopefully we can do a whole lot more than just a resolution in the future. Thanks.
Any other questions?
If I could, just one more comment, if I could. What we're really talking about here, I think, is a system. The House Joint Resolution deals with reimbursement, and that's a fundamental building block not only to help support the clinical use of the system, primarily through physicians, but any other economic advantage actually ends up supporting the system, which has multiple ripple effects, as we've just discussed, distance learning and other kinds of things. So I appreciate the sense that the committee member and committee members are looking at this as a system, too, because it's far from an isolated issue. There are many spin-off benefits to this, and so I certainly would urge your support of this.
Thank you very much.
Representative Cruz, Josie Henderson from the ATSP would like to say just a few words.
That would be wonderful.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Cruz and members of the committee, I want to thank you for considering HJR today and, you know, just say that we are in support of this. I am here today as a member of the Oregon Telehealth Alliance, but I am also the executive director for the Association of Telehealth Service Providers. The association is an internationally based membership organization. We're located in Portland, and we've been around since 1996. We do an annual survey of programs throughout the United States, so we do have some background and knowledge about what's going on in this country. Telehealth has been very successful in the United States in getting health care delivered to rural and underserved areas. There are now over 200 telehealth programs operating throughout the country. In 2001, it is estimated that over 55,000 patient-to-provider teleconsults took place. And in these teleconsults, they've done a number of studies on patient satisfaction, and it turns out that patients are, for the most part, very receptive to receiving health care through telemedicine. And I think it's important to note that in this HJR4, there is a choice for patients. So if they, for some reason, don't like receiving services through telemedicine, they can make that choice to travel. But if they don't want to make the travel, you know, they can opt for the teleconsult. Reimbursement has shown to be really critical in determining whether or not a telehealth program succeeds or fails. In states such as California, Kentucky, Nebraska, Montana, and Tennessee, where reimbursement has been addressed, it's grown steadily and it's shown to be a real viable alternative to traditional health care. Oregon, it's the big stumbling block right now. I think there are a number of organizations and providers that would see the benefit of telehealth and would really like to make it happen, but without the money, it's just not going to. HJR proposes to reimburse telemedicine visits in the same way that Medicare is doing so since October of 2001, and that is just to treat it equally to an in-person visit. And I think that's the best way to make sure that telehealth is used in the most fair and efficient manner possible, is just to make them equal. I think it's a really important issue that Oregonians' health care isn't a matter of where they live, that we make sure there's equal access, and telemedicine has demonstrated that it can equal that access to care. I just want to thank you for considering this resolution. And I think we are all entertaining questions at this time. Are we still? So, yeah, everybody.
Any additional questions on the committee? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kim, I think in your testimony you mentioned that under point three, reimbursable services should include clinician-to-patient services, but not clinician-to-clinician services. And I understand the clinician-to-patient service, but it would seem to me that if a neurosurgeon with great expertise needs to consult with the family practice doctor in Burns or in Lakeview and convey some information to him that's crucial to that patient, that information is valuable. And it would seem to me that clinician-to-clinician services also should be reimbursable.
Yes, Representative Anderson, I'm speaking at this moment from an employee of a provider organization. Certainly our providers would love to be reimbursed for their consult services to other providers throughout the state. However, those services are not currently reimbursable under most health care plans. And we were not interested in trying to take on the world at this point. We felt that if we could at least initially get reimbursement for patient-to-clinician visits and deal with that issue, that perhaps the second step could be looking at the broader issue. Okay. But we didn't want that to get in the way of this first issue.
And I think under the revenue environment we currently have, that's probably a wise move. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. I'm going to close public hearing on HJR4 and open a work session on HJR4 committee. The amendments, the -2s, basically, the most part, renumber everything and then put a definition in. You have it in front of you. I think it's fairly straightforward, and I entertain a motion to adopt the -2 amendments.
So moved.
Representative Tomei moves the -2 amendments to HJR4. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move HJR4-2 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. I would love to carry it.
Okay. Oh. That takes care of all my work. Representative Tomei moves HJR4 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I just think this is so exciting. It's a wonderful innovation. I'm delighted that this is happening, and it just seems like it would be totally fair to pass this resolution and make sure that physicians get paid.
Yeah, I was watching that on the screen and flashing back to the mid-50s when we got our first black and white TV, and I'm thinking, my God.
He's one beanie.
Yeah. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd agree with Representative Tomei that it's not only the reimbursement, although I think the reimbursement will hasten the process, and it's the conveying of tremendous information and expertise that really will be helpful for the folks in rural Oregon, especially, and hopefully not only throughout Oregon, but bring in international help from specialists that are, you know, right on the razor's edge as far as their knowledge.
Seeing no further discussion, clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Anderson.
Aye.
Representative
Barker. Aye.
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 Aye. HJR4, having received the constitutionally required majority, is declared passed. Representative Tomei will carry, and we will close the work session on HJR4. Thank you, committee. And just keep in mind, this is one of the unanimous things that doesn't go on the consent calendar. So statements need to be made on the record. So. And as I stall for just a minute while Sandy brings people into the room, I'm not stalling very well, am I?
It's the quietest we've been all day.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dalto.
I think that all of the presentations that are made via teleconferencing should have studios like the St. Charles Hospital studio with trees and plants in the back. I thought that was pretty cool.
Okay. Yeah, like St. Charles.
St. Charles is a nice place.
It was a model teleconferencing studio.
It's kind of a model hospital, but we aren't going to get into that right at the moment. We're going to open an informational meeting, Oregon Commission on Children and Families, Current Systems, Barriers, and Upcoming Budget Reductions. And we have Donna Middleton and Randy Frankie. And I see them both. I'm done. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Donna Middleton. I'm the director of the State Commission on Children and Families. And with me today is Randy Frankie, who is a supporter and also working for the Coalition of Commissions on Children and Families. And so we're going to sort of do a little tag team thing here in order to give you some information about the State Commission on Children and Family System. And I call it a State Commission on Children and Family System because it consists of the State Commission, which are members appointed by the governor, including the Director of Human Services and the Superintendent of Public Instruction. And then two members, one from the House and one from the Senate, and then 12 members that are appointed by the governor. Also, we have 36 local commissions that work very hard in their local communities to provide services and supports, facilitation, community comprehensive planning for communities, which advise the state on how we look at how we do our children and families business. And other than our local commissions, we also have a number of programs that we also support in communities. Healthy Start. I'm sure a number of you are familiar with Healthy Start Home Visiting. It's a home visiting system for our first birth families. And I'm happy to say that we're getting excellent, excellent results from that service. The other great program that we have is Relief Nurseries. We have 7 relief nurseries in the state, and those are providing excellent services to very high-risk families with young children 0 to 5 years of age, and they provide lots of help and support for those families. Another service that we value highly in the commission system is the court-appointed special advocate program. That program provides support to abused children and is a partner with the court system to support the services and needs of children that have been abused and neglected. We've got lots of things we do. We also support child care by using child care federal block grant money in communities through our local commissions to look at training and support for child care programs and the folks who do very, very difficult work in child care. We look at quality child care. We look at training for child care providers. We look at what we can do to improve that quality. And our local commissions are integral to that particular opportunity. We also have work around our early childhood systems. We are the lead agency for both the community comprehensive planning, which was the legislation that was in 1999, and we're also the lead agency for legislation in 2001 around the children's plan, which was around early childhood systems of support. Did I forget anything? Let's see. I want to talk a little bit now about, we had a list of things that we wanted to share to make sure that you understood a little bit about our system, but I don't want to take up a lot of time because we also have three counties here that want to talk with you about how it looks like on the ground, which is really where our system has its best work. So I want to talk a little bit about some of our accomplishments to date. I have, and I'll leave this with you. It's not in your packet, but I will leave this with you. We have had great success in our community comprehensive planning. We have had thousands of folks in communities get together and plan for their children and families in every community in this state. And many of those folks are representative of their communities. So I'm not just talking about service providers and folks who are in the system, sort of public employees. I'm talking about members of the clergy, business community folks, education, parents. All sorts of citizens have come together to plan together for what is in the best interest of their children. And not only to focus on the risk behaviors, but also to focus on what strengths are needed in communities to support those children and families. We too often go to what the negative issues are in communities, and we forget to talk about what communities bring to the table in the way of strengths. So we try to balance that discussion and talk about it as a systems approach to children and families. We also have a plan that our state partners have participated in, and a state plan will be coming out soon that talks about how all 36 counties have identified issues. That should be It's in the printers now, so it should be available soon. But the other work has been at the state level, and that work has been around all the partners in the state agencies that have been around the table helping support that planning. We have the Department of Human Services, we have the Department of Education, we have the Criminal Justice Commission, we have the Oregon Youth Authority. We have housing and community development. We have community colleges and workforce development. All of those folks are around the table working differently and stronger together than ever before. We also have provided information to local commissions around best practices and research. One of the things that we've heard over and over again is we need to get better at doing the research and really understanding what works for communities. And we have done extensive work around giving communities that information to help them support their services in communities. As I said before, we have Healthy Start. Healthy Start has been one of the top priorities for most of our communities for a number of years. The legislation was instituted in 1993, and only last session were we able to expand Healthy Start to all 36 counties, and almost all 36 of those counties are now up and running with the Healthy Start program. We also have documented evidence that Healthy Start is making a difference in our communities. Some of that is attached to the material that you have, so I'm not going to go through that. We also, with our court-appointed special advocates, have a number of citizens, as you all know, involved in volunteering to support our abused and neglected children. We have first conducted a statewide evaluation, the first evaluation that we've had of court-appointed special advocates. And one of the things we did was survey judges across the state to see how they felt the work of the court-appointed special advocate was helpful to them in their work. Overwhelmingly, we had very high marks for the work that the CASAs are doing around the community work. It was very gratifying to hear that the judges really supported their work. Relief nurseries. We have relief nurseries in which we are also supporting an evaluation and data collection so that we can once again let them tell their story in that particular way. And they have, the folks that have, they have served have had abuse rates that have been decreasing and improved functioning of the families that are in their services. So it's really been very good. We had a good success in receiving $2 million in additional child care block grant money. And I have to say, because I heard it directly from Legislative Fiscal, was that the reason we received $2 million more in child care block grant monies was because the community comprehensive plans had identified child care as one of their highest priorities. So what you're seeing is that the plans are coming to the legislature, and people are beginning to read them and use them for how they want to support communities and what communities are saying to them. And those dollars have been distributed to 11 counties in our state to look at best practices around child care and to be supportive of those issues around our child care community. We also have a Positive Youth Development federal grant, and that Positive Youth Development is working on sort of embedding the positive youth development opportunities for communities. And then we also are working on an early childhood systems development, which was part of the children's plan, in which we are asking communities to get together to support their earliest families and to be supportive as a system. So in that system, you would find Healthy Start. You'd also find Head Start. You'd find the baby's first opportunities with public health. You'd find early intervention. You'd find a whole group of folks sitting around the table trying to figure out what's in the best interest of their earliest populations. That wasn't happening a few years ago. It's happening now. And state and local commissions have provided valuable leadership in that happening in this state. And so I wanted to highlight a few of those things for you because I think they're very, very important to our system. Representative Cruz also asked me to talk a little bit about challenges because I think with those very, very positive results, we're also working very hard on the challenges that we have. One of the challenges is we need to be creating a more effective data collection system so we can really talk about the results of our work. And I'm happy to say that we're working very hard on that with the Department of Human Services, and at least for the early childhood piece of our work, should have a prototype out for across the systems data collection in early childhood so we can compare what it looks like and how well we're doing with our earliest families. That should be tested in March of this year and should be ready to go by the first of 2004. And I'm really pleased with that. The Commission has worked very hard with the Department of Human Services and the Department of Education to try to pull that information together so we can tell a story that is supportive of the work. Expanding partnerships. You know, even with the work, and I just mentioned earlier about all the folks who've been at the table, we can still do better with bringing in our local partners. And so we're working very hard with our partners to bring them not only into the planning but into the discussion for children and families. And so you'll see that as an ongoing issue, an ongoing challenge. Some counties have every public system at the table, and some are still working hard to bring in some of those services and partners. And then training and technical assistance for communities with best practices, with looking at outcomes, with really supporting it. You know, we're stretched at the state level to provide that technical assistance and training. We've got most of the folks out in the field most of the time, and we still can't get to where we need to go as much as we'd like to go. And I think without that partnership between the state and the local communities, I think one of the main roles of the State Commission is to provide that technical assistance and support. And so we try as hard as possible to put as many people out there to do that. But it's still a challenge given the resources and those kinds of things. And then I think the access to information. There's a lot of information being thrown at people now. I mean, just, you know, don't get me on email and computers, but just how do we help them decipher that information and support all the information that's going to them around what we need for them to do, and that's always a struggle. And then I guess the last one is competing expectations, and I debated on whether to talk about this, but I'm going to anyway, because what happens is, as a state system, we are asked. I was just making a presentation earlier this week on prevention and the joint judiciary ways and means opportunity that we had, and we were talking about prevention. And at the end of that discussion, we were hearing you need to have research-based, they need to be targeted, they need to be focused on outcomes, and you know, they need to be essential. So the State Commission tries very hard to support our local commissions in having all of those things happen. But our local commissions are saying to us, well, you're asking us to do all of these things. We want it to be more flexible, and we want it to be more directed in our communities to where we want it to be. So we are, you know, in sort of a caught-in-the-middle situation here about wanting to make sure they can tell their story and wanting to make sure their value is well known, and at the same time letting them be as flexible and supportive of their local community's needs. And that's a difficult balance to keep going as a state system with local partners that you want to support. So I put that out and say, you know, we need your help and support in finding that balance. We're working hard at it, but, you know, we're kind of getting hit by both sides. You need to do this, or you know, you don't get that. And we value the system enough to try to support it as much as possible. So, Representative Cruz, I now have some budget information, but I defer to you for questions first.
Thank you, Donna. Just in your last comment about meeting expectations, if I'm understanding you, you're saying that, as I recall from our conversations last session, we talked a lot about prevention, and this is what you're trying, I'm assuming, to get to the local commissions. But the problem is, if I'm hearing you and guessing what it is that the local commissions, that we also expect them to be independent in a sense, that they will come up with their own goals.
Mm-hmm.
And so is that what I'm understanding, is that we're saying to you, Donna, that you need to work on prevention, and the local commissions may be saying, but that's not where we are right now. Well, this is where we want to be. Am I correct in assuming that?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, partly. I think it is that we're asked to make sure that we have data to support what we're putting into communities, that it's focused on best practice and research, and it's targeted. And local communities would say, we will do as much of that as possible, but we also want the autonomy to put things in places that may not be research-based, that may be something that doesn't look as high needs focused as maybe others would see it as being. And so it's that balance that we have to try to reach as a system. Jillian from Douglas County said something that Randy and I said, wow. She said we're kind of like life insurance. People want it, but they don't want to pay for it. In other words, it's very nebulous. I mean, it's about being out there and being an insurance policy for the community that supports preventing something before it happens, if you will. But it's a nice thing to have, but do we want to pay for it? I see our system as similar to that particular thing.
Thank you, Don. Mr. Chair.
Jillian's smart, isn't she?
Well, Randy and I both said, wow, that's a great analogy, but it is.
Maybe this chair needs to talk to the Senate Judiciary Chair. I don't know. My vision of this system is it's outcome-based, and the outcomes that are determined at the local level. It's not so much data-driven. So it kind of highlights our problem here is we're asking for two things. So maybe Senator Minnis and I need to go out to dinner one night and talk about this. Please go ahead.
Chair Cruz, I appreciate that. I hesitated to bring that up, but I think it's an important issue.
If it's a reality, it's a reality, and it's understandable from their perspective. When we're trying to get the best bang for the buck especially when you look at what the reductions that we're looking at. A prioritization becomes hard if you're trying to prioritize. Prevention is always hard to prioritize because how do you measure things that don't occur? And then how do we give autonomy if we can't put numbers behind it? I mean, it's a dynamic we've been struggling with since I've been in the building. So,
I appreciate your anything that you could do to support and give us information around that. And we really want to do what is in the best interest of our children and families. And we want to make sure that they get at least a piece of what they need. We understand the budget issues. So with that, I'll go into your last sheet has a budget reduction summary of the State Commission's budget. What you have is that... the first sentence talks about a 10% reduction from current service levels would be, in the commission system, $7,150,000. We are currently at $12.4 million in reductions. That's a 23% reduction. And as you see, we outlined it around special sessions, second and third, and what the reductions were, so you can see those. And then House Bill 5100 and what those reductions are. We're losing some of our locally invested funds. We have eliminated, as of February 1st, family resource centers in seven counties. We have eliminated Together for Children, which is a parenting service. Ironically, parenting is one of the number one issues that have been identified in our community comprehensive plans. And we're reducing that piece of our business. We've reduced our court-appointed special advocates by 10%. They only get $1.4 million. So even though it doesn't look like a big number, 10% is a lot. You know, they count on volunteers, but volunteers need coordination and they need support. And then our locally invested funds, as you can see, we're looking at a $1.3 million reduction. That's just in the last 5 months of this budget year. And then the governor has recommended for our balance 2003-2005 another reduction of $5.3 million in our locally invested funds. And he did, however, support Healthy Start at the continuance 65%. At one time, it was at 80% last session and has been rolled back now to 65%. And the governor did support that in his budget. And then he, because Relief Nurseries had taken a considerable hit and was down to 58%. He added back in his budget about $912,000 for next biennium to bring them up to 74%. So that's not whole, but that's bringing them back up to 74%. So that's an overview and a perspective of where we currently are with our budget.
How many counties are at 65% in Healthy Start?
We have three counties that are not at 65% at this time. That are not.
Everybody else has reached that.
Everybody else actually has reached it and has exceeded it in a lot of cases.
What's Sandy Mona Sanderson?
What I don't see here is the total budget. And I tried to look at your handouts. How much goes to the State Commission on Children and Families, and then how much is distributed out? Just big numbers.
Our budget is around $80 million total, which includes both state and federal funds, Representative Anderson. And what we have is our state budget is around $3 million of that $80 million.
So you're saying out of the $80 million, only $3 million comes from general fund?
Oh, no. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Mona Sanderson. No. About 60%, let's see, 60 million, I'm trying to remember, I apologize for not having, about 60 million is from state general fund, rounded numbers, and about 20 million is from federal funds to get to the 80. And then 88% of that goes directly to local commissions and these programs that I mentioned. 88%.
Thank you.
So the governor's recommended is what, about 48 mil general fund, roughly?
Roughly.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Ms.
Yes,
Randy?
Thank you.
I apologize for not bringing that piece.
What do you got? Is Randy ever going to say anything?
Yes, I'm going.
You know, I've never known him to be silent.
I'm gonna defer now to Randy.
Morning, Randy.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Donna. My name is Randy Frankie. I have been employed by the Coalition of Local Children and Family Commissions to represent them and work with them through this legislative process. I'm going to try to be brief because I want to make sure you hear from three of our local commissions and the work they're doing, because I think that's probably the most important thing that we can share with you this morning. But let me just introduce by saying a little bit about the coalition. The coalition serves as a forum for the leaders of the 36 local county children and family commissions to come together and talk about this system that Donna was referring to from the local perspective, and to discuss changes and improvements that we see that are needed in the system, and try to come to an agreement of which of those we want to move forward as a group of 36 county commissions. We also obviously look at the budget issues and try to take positions on those, as well as look at bills that are introduced by others in terms that would have an impact on the system that we're involved in, and decide which of those bills we either support or oppose, or changes that we may want to see in those, so that it'll, the local path of the system certainly works well. I would also say our members are equally concerned, though, that the state half of the system works together. It is a system, and for it to function, we need both parts of it to function. At times, there is what I would call, and I think Donna referenced it, some dynamic tension, which isn't all bad, between the two halves of the system. We have some components of the system that you will see are uniform in every county, such as Healthy Start. I think that's a prime example. It was one of the number one priorities for the coalition for 2 to 3 sessions. And even though a number of the members of the coalition already had Healthy Start up and running, it still, we felt it was such an important component of this system that every county should have this piece. And yet there will be other things you'll hear. People talk about flexibility. That's where the local commission looks at what their situation is for their children and families, and there may be some issues in that community that need to be addressed that aren't consistent across the state in other counties as well. So that's that flexibility coming in, and I'm sure you'll hear a great deal about that. When House Bill 2004 was passed in 1993, I think it made Oregon a leader in this country in looking at how we do business differently to support better outcomes for children and families, and working with families in the communities in which they live. I think we're still a leader in that area, and we hope that after this session we can move forward and strengthen that system to continue to focus on better outcomes for children and families. I could talk a long time on this, but I'm not going to this morning because I want to make sure we have time for our local folks. We have people that have come to share some stories with you from Douglas County, Benton County, and Yamhill County this morning. And I will be around the whole session and maybe have opportunities to talk with you individually a little bit more about the coalition and the system and some of the details. I'll hopefully have an opportunity to set up a meeting with each of you and visit with you a little bit. But right now I'd like to have the representatives from Douglas, Benton, and Yamhill come forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Randy. Jillian always has handouts. I mean, even when she's not testifying. I mean, you just meet her on the street, she has handouts.
I do. Even at parties or whatever, yeah. I have handouts. I live and breathe them, don't I?
Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Cruz and members of the committee, I'm Jillian Nicolaitis. I'm a director of the Douglas County Commission on Children and Families. And what I wanted to go back to for one second is, as we discussed on Monday, and you saw the PowerPoints, we talked about promoting wellness, mobilizing communities, and developing policy and overseeing the implementation of a coordinated comprehensive plan for children and families. And what I find in my community, and what my chair, who's a retired mayor, finds in our community, that when I talk about intangibles in life insurance, it's something that you really can't see, so you really have to explain what the worth is. And that's what I'm hoping that we can help to fill in the gaps of what was presented here on Monday. When we talk about creating a wellness system in 1996, way before the State Commission talked about having an early childhood group, we realized that we had gaps in our early childhood group, but we also realized that the people in the group, we didn't have a group, we pulled one together, didn't know what each other was doing. Head Start was doing some parenting, but the other, you know, the health department didn't know that, or the courts didn't know that. And so what we did in 1996 was we pulled people together like our school districts, our relief nursery, early intervention, Head Start, mental health, Healthy Start, the library, our Umpqua Community College, because they have an early childhood section in their college, battered persons, our respite care, child care resource referral, DHS, and child care providers. And we said, okay, we have all these wonderful things. Does everyone here know what exists? And we didn't. So what we did was we went back to the very beginning and said, okay, what do you do? What do you do? What do you do? And after we mapped everything, we said, okay, what's missing? And if we're duplicating, why are we doing that? And so what we did was we changed the way we did business. We did it, you know, leaner and meaner, and we were so excited about what we did that we applied for a Ford Family Grant because we identified parenting for child care providers and the families that go to the child care providers as a critical piece, and we got the grant. And that was in 1998, and in 1999 and year 2000, this 2001 and 2002, we got grants from the Cow Creek Indian Foundation because they saw what we were doing, and it's kind of picked up momentum. So that's what happens when you pull people together and you look at things, you map things, and you find out what exists and what needs to be happening. It's kind of like we're the glue that keeps these pieces together and keeps it going. Also, what we found was we, as a commission, had federal dollars. We had federal child care dollars, and we found that child care providers were telling us that the kids they were getting were tougher. And if you look at the subsidies they get, and you look at they get the kids from SCF, or the used to be SCF, and they get the kids from what used to be, you know, child family self-sufficiency, and they get really hardcore kids. So they had issues like, well, how do we identify mental health issues in children? How do we identify depression? What do we do with the aggressive kids? And we're not prepared for that. So we got together as a group, our coalition, the Douglas County Coalition for Early Childhood, and we said, okay, if we use our commission dollars, why don't we give it to the child care group, the coalition, and why don't you decide what you want to do? And they got together, we all got together with mental health and said, okay, let's put on a training for these hardcore issues. Because if you think about it, the child care providers have the kids for a longer period of the day, and they're not prepared for some of these hard issues. They're really not. As the commission looked at the work of that the early childhood group was doing, they became an advisor to us, and now they are part of our system. A second role that we do is we, as commissions, mobilize communities. And we have a judge in our community who is the domestic violence judge. Her name is Joan Seitz, Judge Joan Seitz. And she realized that, just as we realized in our early childhood coalition, that there's many links, that we're all working on the same families. A lot of times if judges talk to you, they can tell you the names of the families that are having problems in your community, and so can all your agencies. And we pulled together a group of people, and she asked me, she said, okay, what do I do? I know I have an issue. What do I do with this issue? I said, okay, let's research it. Let's pull the people together, and I'll facilitate it for you. And what we did was we said, okay, we have this issue of children witnessing violence, and it transcends many areas. What are we going to do about it? The schools were a little defensive and said, well, gee, we don't want one more thing. And we said, no, we don't want you to do one more thing. We want to educate you. We want to help you to help these kids. We don't want to expect anything more from you than you're already doing. So we're pulling the group again together, and our second meeting will be in March, and it will be to help them assess and identify the kids who witnessed violence. And then where we're going to go from there is each agency has committed that they will look at what they're already doing, and we'll all look at how we're going to do it better. And that's what happens when you mobilize and you pull together and you all work together. I guess it used to be called synergy. I don't know what they call it these days. You make more out of something that exists already. Okay, so also what I'd like to say is when you look at commissions, particularly, you know, any commission, ours includes a mayor, a retired teacher, a police chief, a deputy district attorney, a school superintendent, a school principal, a physical therapist, a retired investor, a community college administrator, a school resource officer, and our most important member is our youth representative from our youth advisory group, which kind of keeps us in line. We also have a strong connection with Commissioner Joyce Morgan, who is our liaison and who advocates for us in the community. And I also handed out a summary of our comprehensive plan, which will show you what the community came together and looked at as our priorities. As I went around to a couple people in the last couple days, I asked them, I said, could you give me a quote? I have to testify, and I need something from you that tells me and tells the group of people I'm talking to, what do we do? What's our added value? And I have two quotes for you. One of them is from a high-level local state employee, and what she said is, our local commission provides the community with an alternative way to resolve disputes by bringing together partners and making sure that the talking keeps going and doesn't break down. The commission is a friendly, neutral watchdog which keeps the best interests of our community at the forefront. The second quote I have is from a school psychologist, and what he said was, the local commission Whoops, I got to make sure it's the right page. The local commission is a spark plug, and he really emphasized the word spark plug, which provides leadership for key issues of community concern. It draws together groups, agencies, and individuals that might not have thought of working together before on a particular topic. The local commission is also the multiplier which keeps on top of county, state, and federal trends and matches community needs as the catalyst to leverage dollars. When the commission calls a meeting, I always attend because I know that together we will create solutions. So I hope that those quotes are more descriptive than a lot of things we're saying, because if you talk to the people that we work with on the ground, things happen that didn't happen before. So I thank you, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Please go ahead.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Joanne Miller. I'm the director of the Commission on Children and Families in Benton County. And I came before you today to talk to you a little bit about what's happening in Benton County, and I'll try and be brief because I know the hour's getting late and my meter's running out.
That can be expensive.
And that can be very expensive in Marion County. They're very good here in Salem, Azara, and Corvallis, so I always am kind of staying on to that. The commission system, and I came a part of the system when I moved to Oregon in 1995, but I researched before I made that decision to come here to find out what was happening in Oregon once I was offered the position. And I got pretty excited because what we were trying to do in the state of Washington was similar to what was already happening in Oregon. The opportunity for local people to decide for themselves what's the best things for children and family in their community, using local resources, bringing partners to the table, and better identifying what those needs are and developing solutions that put result in the outcomes that were positive. There was also a strong emphasis on prevention, which, as Representative Cruz indicated, you can't measure prevention. It's the result of the juvenile department director saying, well, there's only 42% kids now going through our system as opposed to 56%, and the county commissioner wants to know, well, why do you need more money? Well, that's what, why, because we're keeping them out. So that's what prevention is to us. And I was really impressed with the opportunity to have that local voice at the table and to be able to shape policy in the community. When I moved to Benton County, they were in the midst of finalizing what they called a continuum of care, and I got deeply invested in that continuum because it looked at the opportunities, the gaps, and the barriers and the needs of families from womb to tomb. And it was really interesting and exciting to see 800 citizens involved in a process that helped change the life they currently had in that community to something more positive. We then moved on into a more comprehensive approach with not only looking at children and families, but bringing in the elderly, bringing in the disabled, bringing in other partners that weren't traditionally thought of when they think of children and families. We looked at the homeless situation. We looked at the system as it revolved around juvenile justice. And so we moved from those informal process to a more formalized approach. And this is with the direction of the State Commission on Children and Families. And we've been partnering and taking their technical assistance and using our expertise in the community to help develop those plans. I gave you some bulleted outlines of some, from the historical perspective. I gave you some opportunities to look at our how our community has mobilized around each of those areas along the continuum. And one of our most important pieces that I think has resulted in this community planning is our shelter for runaway and homeless youth. And it was a strong problem in our community because there was no opportunity for kids who were in crisis, for families and parents who were in crisis, to give them some cooling off time and a place that was safe. We looked and from 1997 on and tried to figure out how will we provide some shelter services for kids, and as a result we have a Jackson Street Youth Shelter that was developed from a community partner taking the lead from a plan that was developed by a group of concerned citizens that created a shelter care system. And now we have a shelter. I provided you with a success story, some of the services they have provided just this calendar year is that little chart. So that's been what I've experienced in Benton County and in the state of Oregon, this opportunity to be involved locally, to encourage other citizens to get involved at the local level and really help shape policy that support kids and families in the community. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Chairman Cruz, distinguished representatives, my name is William Welling. I'm retired, and I serve on the board of the Commission on Children and Families for Yamhill County. There are two of us here today, and my counterpart will introduce herself. You'll look at some bulleted topics that we have presented to you in our written testimony. I'm not going to highlight and go over those bulleted topics. I want to emphasize some of the verbal things that go with the stars at the bottom and about the commission's role. We echo many of the things that have been stated by the two previous speakers. But the commission in Yamhill County, and I'm sure others the same, looks at the system as a whole. And we're the only one within a community that does that. We bring together those key people in a collaborative partnership way that focuses on the needs of a community. We're the only one, I want to reiterate again, that performs that role within a community. Your commissions, many of them are volunteers. Many of them are retired, like myself, who have a strong belief in what we do with early childhood and families, and prevention is the most important thing that we can do. The commission's role in seeing that happens in both large and small communities in a very diverse geographical region of the state is paramount. If you do not have that kind of service, then you go back to one of different people and different groups vying and duplicating and not processing what needs to be done within a community in a comprehensive manner. So our role is to focus within the community and focus the community as a whole system.
Thanks. Chairman Cruz and members of the committee, my name is Deborah Bridges, and I'm a volunteer on the Commission on Children and Families in Yamhill County, and I'm the executive director of our local United Way. And I have had a long relationship with our local commission because the time between Senate Bill 2004 and 555, I was employed by the commission and was working in local communities, working on community progress team development. And I am thrilled. I am so excited to be here to talk to you about our local commission because I am very proud of the work that we do and all the commissions in the state. It's very exciting. I'm going to talk about point two on our page, and I'm going to be real brief too because obviously we highlighted briefly some of the things our local commission does, and a majority of those programs or initiatives were really started at the grassroots levels in Yamhill County. Our commission is a very dynamic group, and to characterize them as a spark plug would not be inappropriate. And some of the things that we've really found to be missing was that lack of coordination. We started the early childhood, early childhood council. And it's really the various disciplines who work within the child care development field. And we come together on every 2 months for 2 hours to really talk about what's happening. And so much has changed. So, you know, we've been really able to work together to help get grants started for the Head Start or for different programs, and that cooperation has just been invaluable. Our mantra in our local commission, and any meeting you sit through, you're going to hear these words: community, accountability, and leverage. And we really do a fabulous job doing all of that. I get to talk a little bit about our commission successes. I talked about the community progress teams, and those have just been a really driving force for our work in the local communities. And it was my job to go out into the communities and say, hey, let's do this project and come to the table and we have money. And people were very suspicious. We have 10 communities in Yamhill County, and they're also very different. And while we're a relatively small community, some of them are so far apart in their beliefs and their willingness to work together. What struck me was very strange was that going out into the communities and trying to get people to the table, they didn't feel that confidence that they had to be able to sit down and talk about the issues in their community. They'd never been asked, simply. And so the little bit of money, seed money, I think it was $5,000 a community that we had to get them to the table was just, you know, it just, they blossomed. And now they have really band together as individual communities. They're working together across community lines, which I'll tell you, we have two communities, Wilhelmina and Sheridan, and they're, you know, neck to neck. And they won't even talk to each other on some issues, but the community progress teams are the link that help forge partnerships.
you know, our commission and any commission isn't just merely planning and facilitation and accountability. What we really do is provide an essential service out in those communities. We have just been working so hard at our community mobilization piece, and our community progress teams with those $5,000 seeds, collectively over the last few years, they've leveraged about $350,000 in outside money. And I'm not talking about money that they've gotten from a state program. We're talking about writing community grants. I'd say that the majority of those folks have never written a grant before. They've gotten very savvy about fundraising, going to talk to the pizza shop about donating pizza for some family plan, you know, event surrounding parenting. And so it's just really great to be able to see that success. And that wouldn't happen, honestly, wouldn't happen without our local commission supporting that work. We bring people to the table. We've had over 11,000 hours in volunteer time clocked. And I'll tell you, as a person who was responsible for charting some of that, this is low. Communities don't like to fill out all those reports. And so I know that that is an underestimate. And what I want you to know is that we connect our local citizens to services. And it might seem ridiculous. You look in your phone book and you see what programs are in there, but that doesn't really make any sense to people who are in need. And our local community progress teams are there. There's somebody that they know in their community. They might just go up to Kathy Byers from Sheridan and say, Kathy, you know, I'm really having struggles with my teenage son, and he doesn't really need a specialized program, but he needs more activities. And Kathy can say, hey, you know what, we're doing this after-school night court basketball. Bring him on over. You know, it's that kind of person-to-person programs and system that system is such a word to use. It's that relationship building that has been a key to what our commission has done. And I just want to talk about one program in particular, which is our safety net. And this safety net program works with families who might be flirting with getting involved with what are they called now? Services to Children and Families. What's their new title?
Child Welfare.
They've been everything since working in this field. Can't keep track of that one. But we have a story about this. It was a voluntary home visiting program. And, you know, obviously with the word voluntary, you know, people knocking on your door, it's like, oh, you know, we don't know if you want to let you in. And there's a story about this homeless family. And this isn't a made-up story. This is honest to goodness story. A family of four that came to the community safety net. And the mother had cerebral palsy. The father was unemployed. They had a 5-year-old son with autism and a 3-year-old daughter. I have a 2-year-old daughter and a 4-year-old daughter. My husband is gainfully employed. I'm employed. You know, it's stressful enough. I can't imagine all of the other issues that that family was dealing with. It took 17 local organizations to get them housed and to get the father employed, to get services for the family. And now they're together. The state didn't have to intervene. But you can imagine the trick of trying to figure out who those 17 organizations, part of them were, you know, County Health and Human Services. They were the churches. They were community organizations. They were St. Vincent de Paul and the Salvation Army, all of those, that the commission helps bring all of that together for one family. And I have a great story about a family with 9 pot-bellied pigs and a 15-year-old horse, but I'll save that for a time when we have more time. Thank you. Unless you're really curious.
Chairman Cruz and other members of the committee, barriers and challenges. I think we all face this one of the same barriers, and that's a reduction in funds for us. And it is paramount when you do that. And then at the point you begin looking, you're not going to, Mother Teresa's, you're going to do good anyway. When you're down and you're kicked, you're going to go out and do it anyway. And that's what we're going to do. Those challenges that we still have are still in the community. We're not going to quit and we're not going to move. Our staff, executive director, has taken to working only 3 days a week. We have other staff who are working less hours, reduced hours, to save monies so we can actually go out into the community and make sure our money goes to community access. Board members are picking up more roles and were staff roles, and board members individually are picking up some of those roles now on commissions and boards and going out and doing some of those things that staff originally did. we're still going to be able to do more collaborative, and we need to do more collaborative, with those private and nonprofit groups and businesses within the community, those partnerships. And we're going to have to step up to the plate and ask them to step up to the plate a little more with their. Because those challenges that we still need to provide those services to the geographical small and large communities in our communities. Our economics are not the strongest in the Portland Metro Paris sub area outside when you have 33% of your students on free and reduced lunch. You know, a geographical region that has strong unemployment. You know, we need to be the social role and that role of facilitating what goes in our communities. The children, the Commission on Children and Families plays an important role and must continue to do that.
Okay, I have just one more thing to say, Chairman Cruz. They told me I only had a couple minutes, but you have to know me to know that that's, you know, impossible. I just wanted you to know that there is no part of our local government, whether it's city government or it's the county government, that can play the role that the commission does, that engages our local community. We have a very suspicious group of citizenry about government role, and there is no community that organization that can leverage our outside dollars or show the measurable results that the commission does. And I'll tell you, we don't want it. You know, the local community members find it really hard to sit through outcome measurement paperwork and this and that. They want to be out there providing those services, and our local commission really makes them understand the value of that. And I just want you to know that our local CCF office really adds value to that work of the community, but it doesn't happen inside their office. It's not happening inside their office walls. It's happening in the 10 communities in Yamhill County, and they really need the support.
I think now we need to let them get on the floor because I spoke on the floor at 11.
Actually, no, we have changed our schedule to where we're now on Fridays on the floor at 8:30 until such a point as we actually start doing bills, I think, or something like that. Anyway.
Thank you for being so patient.
Well, thank you very much. And as I said, was it Monday? Janet Phillips. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Monday. This is the beginning of a discussion that will be engaged in for a couple months. So thank you very much. I appreciate everybody coming, and we're adjourned. Thank you, Lord.